You are listening to a sermon by Evan Kreider, recorded on Sunday, September 8, 2013, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
So turn in your scripture to 2 Kings 5. I'm going to go through the story again, verse by verse, and it's going to be pell-mell. So you read the scripture while I talk about it. So in verse 1, in the background for verse 1, we should remember that the king of Aram and the king of Israel fought each other annually. And this has been going on for years. There were a couple years of peace, but basically, they're at each other's throats. And Naaman was a victorious army commander in the kingdom of Aram. Whenever somebody is victorious in the Old Testament, the writers attribute it to God. And when they lose, they attribute that to not obeying God. In verse 2, raids were the most common problem between the neighboring nations. Both the Arameans and the Jews stole each other's animals. They sometimes enslaved children, people, and burn crops. Basically, nothing has changed. In verse 3, we need to remember that people tended to see slaves as being inferior in every way to those who captured them. And so the unnamed slave girl, doesn't even have a name, is remembering stories from her home, and she wants to help her master, but dare not approach him, so she goes to her mistress and gives all she can give information, which may help. She doesn't know. Verse 4, Naaman and his family are apparently so desperate that they are willing to try alternative medicine, even risking going to a hostile foreign land without the guarantee of a safe conduct. Verse 5, the story tells, has Naaman taking an unbelievable amount of wealth along in order to get cured. Even back then, people assumed that private health care would be exorbitantly expensive. Verse 8, finally the stage is set for the story. The monarch and all the government are at an impasse. They don't have a clue what to do. And so Elisha can be introduced into the story and solve the king's difficulties once again. We call this book 2 Kings. Actually, it used to be called the Book of the Prophet. The kings are mentioned in chronological order, but it's really about what God does through the prophets. Verse 10, Elisha does not deign to meet Naaman or even greet him, but through a mere servant instructs Naaman to perform a ritual, which he really did not like. And the number 7 is a typical ritualistic number. Verse 11, Naaman is furious at being snubbed. Verse 13, Naaman fortunately has good advisors, servants with level heads, men who knew how to get through to him. I assume that they had to do this on a number of occasions. Verse 14, in order for our story to succeed this morning, Naaman must cooperate. And he does. What a relief. All is well. He is miraculously healed in absentia, or Elisha's in absentia. And this absence of Elisha makes it very clear that God did the healing, not Elisha. Verse 15, Naaman converts to monotheism. Verse 17, Naaman assumes that Yahweh is in part a local god, and that any sacrifices offered to Yahweh must be done on Yahweh's soil. And so he asks for 2 loads of soil. Presumably he's going to use the soil to make bricks, and then from those bricks build an altar, and then he'll do the burnt offerings that way to Yahweh. Verse 18 is the crux of the story, and why I've chosen it. Reuben is the god of thunder and storms. His main temple was in Damascus, and on that spot where the temple used to be, the Romans then built a temple to Zeus. And now on that spot, there is a mosque. So that site has been a sacred site to people of at least three religions over the course of thousands of years. Verse 18, "But may the Lord pardon your servant on one count. When my master goes into the house of Reuben to worship there, leaning on my arm," in other words, I am his right-hand man, "and I bow down in the house of Reuben. When I do bow down in the house of Reuben, may the Lord pardon your servant on this one count." Elisha said to him, "Go in peace." Now some reflections. Whether this miracle story literally took place as it's told, or whether it is essentially urban legend, does not matter to me. I wonder, why is the story being told? Why was the story written down? And what is there in the story that I should pay attention to? First, I see that Elisha views Naaman not as a powerful or wealthy general, not as a foreigner, not as a non-Jew, not as a pagan, but simply as a human being who has leprosy. By contrast, the unnamed king of Israel saw Naaman as a five-star general from an enemy country, a military threat, someone to be feared. How do we look at people? Second, we see that Elisha did not place any religious conditions on Naaman other than undergoing a bizarre ritual of washing in the filthy Jordan River. Elisha did not ask Naaman to change his religion, to admit that monotheism was the way to go. He did not ask him to stop fighting the Jews or even return the slave girl. Nothing was required. Healing was a gift from God. Now, this unexpected twist to the story would have seemed significant to Jews who lived in exile as slaves in a polytheistic culture which had just crushed their Jewish culture. This story would have seemed very unfair. Jews hearing the story may well have wondered why their God and even their prophet did not require conversion. They were to convert. Or circumcision. They had to go through that. Or these bizarre dietary rules which they had to follow. They didn't do any of that, and they were still blessed by God. What's going on? Is this the way God is going to start looking at other pagans, like the people who are our masters and captured us? But most of all in this story, I'm fascinated by Naaman's truly interesting request, verse 18. He tells Elisha that even though I, Naaman, know there's only one God, and even though I'm going to build an altar to God and worship God, my job requires, back in what's now Syria, that I go with my king into the temple and that we bow down together, I as his high official, and worship the god Reuben. And I hope Yahweh doesn't mind. Now this part of the tale is set up in a chiastic structure. And if you turn your bulletin one more page, you'll see how it's set up. It shows to me that this truly is a central point in the story. And I'm using a translation for this illustration which best illustrates this. You'll see A, B, C, X, where I'm the right-hand man, and then it goes backwards, C, B, A. I'll read it. "For this thing, may the Lord pardon your servant. When my Lord comes to the house of Reuben to worship there, and he leans on my hand, and I worship in the house of Reuben, may the Lord pardon your servant for this thing." Elisha's answer is as profound and perplexing as it is simple. Go in peace. This is an technique of narration that's used a number of times in Old Testament Hebrew scriptures. The narrator contrasts two people in a conversation by giving them different styles of narration. The one person may have a very elaborate style, as Naaman does here. It's even poetic, and it's so elaborate that it's a mirror reflection of itself going out. And then to contrast, he has the answer be basically one word, almost shalom, just go in peace. But what might this answer have meant to Jews hearing this story being told and retold to them, especially while living in exile, deep in surrounding culture of foreign idols and foreign ways, where they were being pressured to worship foreign gods, just like Naaman, or they were being pressured to compromise their faith, just like Naaman? It is assumed that the book of Deuteronomy was pulled together either shortly before or around the same time that finishing touches were being put on the books of the prophets and kings. The conclusion to our story this morning is the very sort of compromise that the entire book of Deuteronomy tried to prevent. Believers blending into the surrounding pagan cultures and participating in them. This story about Elisha reminds me that the secular world, the real world, the world of power, politics, education, sometimes offers options, each of which seem fatally flawed or even dead wrong. As I read and hear the debate about Syria, I'm struck by this. There just does not seem to be a right option. In this world of genuine dilemmas, Elisha did not ask obedient Naaman to convert openly. He did not ask him to build a new altar in a public place and draw more worshipers to God. He did not ask him to die for his faith and become the first martyr in Syria. He did not ask him to stop entering the temples of idols, and Jews were required to tear them down. He did not ask him to change his job. He did not even ask him to stop raiding Jewish towns. Elisha, for whatever reason, went so far as to seem to accept the somewhat deceitful compromise proposed by Naaman, where he would appear to worship the idol, even if in his heart he did not. Are there, in the real world, two standards for believers? Is there one standard for those of us who were born into a religion and live in it in Canada? And then another standard for new converts living elsewhere where Christianity is a tiny minority? Paul seemed to think so. At times, Paul encourages Jewish Christians to continue in their Jewish ways, to continue following the diets so that they don't upset the other Jews around them, and continue being separate from secular society. And at the same time, Paul says to new Greek converts that they are allowed to blend into pagan society. They are allowed to ignore Jewish rituals, regulations. They don't have to be circumcised, and this means the men can go in the public baths and not be identified as Jews. Just how flexible are we about our religion? How flexible are we about our faith? How in the world can we be guided in this? Janice and I both descend, in part, from Amish ancestry, from hard-working believers who fiercely tried to follow God in all ways. Those ancestors decided, in part, that this total obedience surely involved a clear separation from secular society. Eventually, Janice's ancestors and mine left the Amish world. Thank goodness. And they became old Mennonites. Mennonites adhering to many, but not all, of the old Amish ways, the old German Swiss ways. And many years later still, Janice's life and mine moved farther from that Amish world. And during our years of working at UBC, our world moved ever closer to the world of Naaman. This past week, Dr. Sarah Wenger-Schenck, president of AMBS, of Anabaptist Mennonite Biblical Seminary in Elkhart, Indiana, close to where I grew up, made a bold statement. She gave the first chapel address this week. And she said, and I find her words fit our fellowship perfectly, "It's not too strong a claim to make that in this place we are insatiably intrigued about what God is up to in the world. We love the big questions and are restless with tidy answers. We love playing with God's stuff, not in a careless, irreverent way, but with inquiry that is animated by wonder. As we seek to live our lives of obedience, our lives of faith, may God be with us as we face the big questions. And whenever we become restless with proposed tidy answers, may we have the fresh new faith of a Naaman, the wisdom of an Elisha, so that we too may go in peace as we quietly attempt to live our lives of faith surrounded by our pagan society. God bless us all."